So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Chris Edmonds. Hi, Chris.
Adrian, how are you, my friend?
I'm very well, sir. I'm very well. So, Chris, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and tell us a bit about the work that you do?
I can. I'm a working musician. I'm sitting in my music studio surrounded by guitars. But that's not how I can make a living, which is unfortunate because I'd love to do that. Uh-huh. But I'm a management consultant. I'm a speaker and I'm an author. And I've had my own firm since 1995, been working full time with the Ken Blanchard Company soon after that. Uh-huh. So I'm basically a speaker and a executive consultant. And basically what I try and do is inspire leaders to make their work environments not only more tolerable, but God forbid, pleasant for people to operate in.
Ah, indeed. So on the back of that, now you recently published a book, and that's why we kind of got together, and it's called The Culture Engine, a framework for driving results, inspiring your employees, and transforming your workplace. Now, can you tell me a little bit about the book and how it came about and why you wrote it and why now? So why now?
Great question. It's interesting because I've had the chance to speak to people about, you know, why a book on culture? You know, there seems to be a bit more interest maybe in the last 5 years or so around workplace culture and why'd you write this book? And you know, being in the trenches with leaders and with teams over the past 20, 25 years or so, I've learned that most organizations don't operate as they could. They're not necessarily inspiring. They're not necessarily treating people with trust, respect, dignity, not only internally, but their relations with customers as well. So I've really seen the need for a practical guidebook, and that's what I tried to do with the Culture Engine, to really lay out a framework, step-by-step guide that says, here's what's worked with the senior leaders that I've worked with and with divisions and plants and teams that I've worked with. And so this approach is very, very much proven, and the benefits are pretty incredible. Okay. What our culture clients have experienced is consistent growth in employee engagement, which has all kinds of benefits, consistent growth in the customer experience, so customer service goes up, and results and profits go up. There's not a lot of downsides to it. The question about, you know, how did this come about? I've been passionate about this and blogging for probably 4 years plus, and podcasting for nearly a couple of years on that stage. And so what has been really helpful has been the response to that and the interest in that. And so, you know, there's nothing like doing a book proposal to be humbled. But I took it to one shop, and it wasn't exactly for them. And I took it to Wiley, and within 24 hours had approval and deadlines and a contract in the works. And so it really did not come to fruition with Wiley until January. And they wanted the book manuscript 60,000 words by the end of April. So that was a bit of a dance, and was pleased to get that done, and just very pleased with the partnership with them.
I mean, before we can move into the sort of some of the books, you did mention then about why some, you know, you sort of alluded to that some organizations aren't necessarily very beneficial sort of places to work, or they don't necessarily have good environments and stuff. Yeah. And is that largely because of, one, how the management are, how the leadership are, how they're set up, or, you know, what are some of the major sort of like reasons that get, but that are obstacles, if you like, in making workplaces kind of basically places that you want to go to?
I think it's the synergy kind of piece. It's what leaders would love to have happen, but I don't believe leaders really have ever been taught, have ever had great role models to know how to do that. Leaders are basically focused upon, I've been told this by some very successful leaders, that they've been basically taught to focus on processes and results. Right. And that exclusive focus can cause the work environment to be dull, frustrating, anxiety-ridden, dangerous, ad nauseum. And so I really looked at how can I help organizations be better places for people to hang out in, better places for people to cooperate in, mm-hmm. better places to serve people well and have fun, God forbid.
Yeah.
And really the lever is leaders. Leaders don't maybe know enough about how their organization is operating. Mm-hmm. They may not know enough about how safe, inspiring their work environment is. So what I know to be true is if I can get leaders to stop and stop doing all this stuff and kind of look around to see, exactly what the health of their work environment is, and to have them go back to their own best bosses, their great bosses. And every time I engage in this conversation with senior leaders, they tell me their great bosses were, they cared for them as people. Mm-hmm. They created an environment where people could actually bring ideas. Mm-hmm. They could bring their best selves. They didn't have to be careful or guarded. They weren't waiting for the next lash or the next stab in the back. And it was a very gratifying experience. They loved Mondays. They loved going into work. And what's interesting is that almost every leader I've ever worked with has had that experience, but they didn't know how to craft it. So what I realized was I need to give leaders a slightly different look at what their job really is, and then to give them the tools, give them the skills, give them the process, so that they can kind of get their own teams not only greater performance, but much, much happier employees in that work environment.
Okay. Situation you're describing sounds a little bit like, that scene in The Wizard of Oz when the wizard comes out from behind the, behind the curtain?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not this omniscient big green face and with a booming voice, but actually it's just a normal person.
Yeah.
And it's about almost like being a regular person and showing kind of, respect and acting in a dignified way and giving people respect and trust and treating them well and, all those different sort of like kind of things that we seem to have lost sight of, but we're in the process of trying to, recapture some of those things.
Right. And I think it's great that there's an increased interest in culture. I think it's great the work that Forbes has done and greatplacestowork.com. We really have some very visible, very well-run organizations that do both, that perform very well and are also immensely satisfying, gratifying, God forbid, inspiring places to work. And there are organizations like WD-40 and Zappos and Asda. And so we actually have shown the light on organizations that do it well. What I don't believe we've done well is to kind of help close the gap between here's what you got and there's this utopia. How do we get you there? And that's the intent of this book.
And so then back to the book. I mean, central to the book is what you call an organizational constitution.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that and why you think it's important, and also then how companies should go about creating one? Because my sense is that it's very different from a vision and mission statement, which you would normally learn about in textbooks and business school and all that sort of like good stuff. But an organizational constitution, that's the heart. Tell me about that.
One of the things that was critical was being able to get this process into a bit of a nice, crisp description that as people heard it, it would make sense to them,
right?
And possibly it would be kind of intriguing to them. So when I say organizational constitution, almost everyone responds with, okay, I get that. An organizational constitution is a set of rules. And it's a set of rules that basically makes values and citizenship as vitally important to the organization's success as results and performance. And so the four elements of an organizational constitution are purpose, which is that very tactical reason for being today. Mm-hmm. And it's beyond the mission statement. A mission statement is I think, a good starting point, but it often is much more aspirational. It's more, that's what we're working to become. It may not be necessarily as descriptive of kind of day-to-day activities today.
Right.
And the purpose statement to me, and again, this has been very beneficial with the clients I've worked with, is what you do, for whom, and to what end. And the thing that is vitally critical is that humans are inspired by great purpose. And the to what end helps you get beyond just making money. Now, making money is a good thing. There's a lot of benefits to making money. You can actually be open the next day. You know, you can continue to serve well. But making money isn't naturally inspiring for the human beings that are engaged in the work. And so how do you get it to, you know, we're basically trying to increase the quality of life of customers, of our communities, et cetera. And that may seem a bit kumbaya to people, but if you, again, go back to your best bosses, your greatest bosses, they inspired you to help create something meaningful every day, something beneficial every day. And so that's that first piece. The second piece is values and behaviors. So it's in good citizenship, very thoroughly and specifically crafted, not in forms of attitude, although that's beneficial, but you can't measure someone's attitude.
Yeah.
If we're going to make citizenship as measurable as tactical performance dashboards, then we have to go to behaviors. And so the trick is to, yes, declare what kind of values you want to demonstrate in every interaction, but then say, you know, what does integrity really mean? Well, integrity means to us, we keep our promises, or we do what we say we will do. Now we've moved that lofty term of integrity to a very tactical promise. And obviously what organizations do well is they measure results, they measure performance frequently. We need to be able to measure values with the same kind of black and white. Are you doing this or are you not? So there's a recommendation for a proven tool to measure valued behaviors twice a year, which gives you then kind of the same kind of black and white data around citizenship as you obviously need around performance. The last two elements of an organizational constitution are about strategy. And they're about goals. And it's critical to have a clear strategy, a strategy that everybody understands. But if goals then are aligned to the strategy, they're also aligned to the purpose. And we commit to, as a team, as a department, as a division, as a company, to actually go about getting those goals accomplished while modeling our desired behaviors. Now we've got something. So the Constitution basically is what can be seen as liberating rules. You're basically crafting a football field, a soccer field, where you've got clear goals, you've got clear behavioral standards, because if you mess with the behavioral standards, you're going to get a yellow card or a red card, right?
Yeah.
So the coaches and your team members are on the side, quote, cheering you on, but they're also working cooperatively to, you know, move the organization, the team forward. So those liberating rules are an additional, I'm going to say, burden, because we are changing the rules a bit, right? We're not going about our work as get the work done, and it doesn't matter how many body bags are piled up in the corner.
Right.
It's about, we're going to get the work done and actually be a safe, inspiring work environment while we do it.
Okay, cool. So you place a lot of importance on the purpose statement. I mean, there's one company here in the UK that has a purpose statement, and I think it's been made in a slightly sort of different sort of context, but nevertheless, they have a purpose statement. I think they went through I've interviewed some people there before, and the company's Aviva, a UK insurer, and they use a systems thinking approach to re-engineer their approach to business. But their purpose statement reads, "Our purpose is to give our customers peace of mind that they have the right insurance cover in place at the right price." So what do you think? Does it stack up? Does it make the grade?
I think it does. And let's go back to those three pieces of a purpose statement. Number one, what do they do? Well, clearly they provide insurance coverage, right? They are, that's their job,
yeah.
Right? But for whom? It's obviously for customers. And you and others listening, we've seen purpose statements that are so bold about we make money for stakeholders. That's not what is being held up and formalized in the statement, which is good. So they have their customers in mind, and to what end is the vital piece? Mm-hmm. And here it's peace of mind. And I really like that. I think it's a different kind of a work environment if our goal is to provide peace of mind. It's not selling the insurance package that we make the most money, but really isn't going to protect the customer, you know, when they get a hailstorm and it ruins their roof or whatever. So I like it. I like it a lot.
That's good. I sent an email off to people I know at Aviva going, purpose statement is wrong. Chris says.
Well, and you're right, and it's interesting because a lot of folks don't know anything different, and so kind of purpose is around making money. And if you can get that beyond, yes, that's a vital requirement of every business on the planet. Now, what's meaningful and what's more purposeful? And I think they got it.
Yeah, cool. But then let me go back right to the very, very beginning of the book. I mean, because you ask a question right at the very beginning. I think it's the first line. And you'd say, is your workplace frustrating and lifeless, or is it engaging and inspiring? Now, I read that and I thought, yeah, but most people are probably going to say, our organization is somewhere in the middle. It's like sometimes frustrating and lifeless and sometimes engaging and inspiring, but most of the time it sort of falls sort of a bit in between. It's got a foot in both camps, or it's just stuck in between. I mean, exactly. So therefore, if you agree with that, and that's the sort of the norm, as it were, I mean, I imagine that if your organization is kind of frustrating and lifeless, it would probably be, you've got the only way is up, as it were. But if you're engaging, it's inspiring, people like going, but everything's fine, it's okay. But if you're stuck in the middle, it can feel a bit like there might be a sense of inertia there. It's like, where do you start with all of this?
Yeah, great question. And what's really key, and you and I have had the chance to connect a bit before our conversation today, it does fall to leaders.
Right.
And I would agree wholeheartedly, most organizations, and I'm kind of being bold with that statement, you know, lifeless and frustrating, engaging or inspiring, as if it's black and white, it's a binary choice, you know, right or left. And the reality is it's a lot of grays, right? Mm-hmm. But if there is anything less than consistent engagement, consistent inspiration, then we're going to drive behaviors that are not going to be pretty. We're going to drive individual accomplishment at the cost of maybe team performance. We've all seen this. Yeah. And so the reality is, who's got the authority and the responsibility to change that?
Right.
And it's not frontline team leaders, it's not frontline employees, it's leaders, because they can change the rules. They can craft a different set of expectations, and then they can change incentives and bonuses and recognition, mm-hmm, to start to basically say, anytime we fall short of, you know, If there's any screw your buddy that's happening, we're falling short of what we want, which is our desired, safe, inspiring, based on mutual trust, respect, dignity kind of a work environment. And it's where I coach leaders that you really don't have to spend 70% of your time, 90% of your time focused on performance. You've hired a whole team to do that. You've got dashboards to do that. What you really need to do to be able to make the organization as safe and inspiring as possible is you got to pay attention to, how are people treating each other? How are people referring to customers? How are they treating internal customers compared to external customers? And it's, how do you take the grays? How do you take that middle kind of inertia ridden, we're stuck and we're kind of embedded with practices? You know, we're really not trying to say you're wrong, you got to fix that. But we want to say, if it's not where you'd like it to be in every interaction, then you have to invest time in that. And the only folks that can really, again, change the rules is it starts with leaders and leadership throughout the organization.
Fantastic. This type of work, you know, working on your culture can have a fantastic impact on your service and your ability to develop and deliver a great customer experience. I mean, is this just basically go back to the service profit chain type of idea, or is there something more to it than that, do you think?
My experience is it really does go back to that service profit chain, and it extends it a bit, because it basically says that if you craft a work environment that treats people with respect, dignity, mm-hmm. and trust, they're going to bring their best selves. They're going to solve problems you didn't even know you had. Mm-hmm. They're going to apply discretionary energy. There's some wonderful work by Dr. Tony Simons out of Cornell University. His book is called The Integrity Dividend. And just stunning insights for me back in 2001 when I first saw it in Harvard Business Review. But it's basically looking at how do you inspire employees to bring their best? And how do you inspire employees to apply discretionary energy when there's nobody else around? And what Simon's work found is that when managers model the values of the organization, there's that values foundation again, and they keep their promises, then discretionary energy goes up, which completely changes the customer experience. Some wonderful, wonderful research. And so basically reiterates that if you pay maybe even greater attention to the quality of your workplace culture and you craft an environment that really does treat people like intelligent human beings that have a choice and they are choosing to come to work here, well, then let's make this engaging and fun and help people learn, and all of a sudden they're going to treat their customers like gold. What a surprise. And what naturally will happen there is you end up with lifelong customers, and the buzz around their neighborhoods and the customers' workplaces is all, if you want insurance, you've got to go to Aviva. And all of a sudden you've got this remarkable positive viral kind of sense of, this is a worthwhile organization to interact with. They won't screw you. And what a surprise. What we've found is that for clients that hang with this, and this is not a quick fix, this is a 18 to 24 month process. You'll probably see significant benefits inside of 10 to 12 months. But what we've seen over a 24-month period is consistent growth in employee engagement, 40% or more, consistent growth in the customer experience and customer service, 40% or more, and this is pretty important for some folks who may be listening, a 35% or more growth in results and profits. Those are stunning.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. And it works. It just flat out works.
I think it's the thing. I forget what the saying is, but there's an old saying that says something like, never doubt the power of a few committed kind of like men or women to change the world.
Totally so. And what you're trying to do is to change the expectations. So, because people can choose to be nice. Mm-hmm. People choose to be self-centered, and in fact, you may have systems that are inspiring people to be self-centered and to screw their buddy. And so you kind of gotta stop and assess. And if you come to the decision that, well, boy, this isn't some place where I'd love my kids to work, or this isn't some place where I had a wonderful conversation with a leader. This was probably 10 years ago, and a new neighbor moved in to his neighborhood. And this gentleman happened to be in the insurance business as well. And the new neighbor moved in, and they're kind of connecting up, and we both had dogs, so we're walking our dogs together, in the afternoon. And so what do you do again? Oh yeah, well, we're moving, so we're gonna need some insurance. And Tom said he felt as though he knew that customers have a tough time getting treated well in his organization. Company's successful, but customers typically, they have to battle to get questions answered. They have to battle to get changes made. And he thought, do I want to have this guy who I'm going to be living with, basically in my neighborhood, angry at the experience that our company puts him through?
Sure.
And now I never followed up to see, so Tom, what'd you tell him? You know, what'd you do? But that's a great question. If your organization doesn't treat people well, mm-hmm. be they internal customers, employees, external customers, there's an opportunity to make it different and make it better.
Wow. So keeping an eye on time and things, and I also don't want to delve into the book and give it all away.
Of course.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, like top tips for our readers and listeners before I ask you my final question?
Absolutely. One of the things that I'm really inspired by and my basic core purpose is driven by having leaders get really clear on what their own values are and live according to those values. You are going to have a much more gratifying life. You'll be able to serve others only if you get a real strong foundation of your own values. And I don't think there's any right values. I don't think there's any wrong values. I just think we've got to be a bit more intentional and be a bit more concerned about who we are being as opposed to all the crap we're doing. And we have a tendency to kind of put our identities into everything we do. So that's the first tip. And the second piece is I would love people to kind of consider some of these ideas. And I blog and podcast on drivingresultsthroughculture.com. That's a big mouthful. But I would love to have folks kind of consider some of these ideas. I also am a regular columnist on Smart Blogs and Entrepreneur. So I would just love to have people kind of look at some of these ideas, and some leaders think I'm pretty far out there. Would love to get people's insights and responses to that, and for them to learn a bit more about the Culture Engine book, they can head to thecultureengine.com.
Fantastic. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll collect all those links up from you, Chris, and when I do the write-up, I'll get it all linked up, and we'll give it all a big shout-out. But I just want to say is that, the framework that you're talking about, it sounds just so, you know that sort of thing, that ideas like common sense that's not very common.
Me too.
And sometimes the common sense is not very common. It can be really hard work. But I salute your the message, and I salute the courage in writing the book, and I enjoyed sort of my quick read of it, and the results speak for themselves. And so fair play, sir, fair play.
Thanks very much. I'm so excited to hear others be equally enthused about the idea. So thank you for that.
And I just want to say thank you for your time today. That's been brilliant.
Wonderful. And thanks to you. And I appreciate your interest in reaching out, and just love the conversation.
Fantastic.